It is Monday, May 13th, 2024, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Matthew Moore.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Today, a new report shows Tyson Foods dumped millions of pounds of toxic chemicals in waterways.
Over 371 million pounds of pollutants between 2018 and 2022. And that is what they told the EPA. That is, you know, just the state of affairs.
Plus, Hillary Rodham Clinton's time in Arkansas.
And I heard this voice saying, not only that, we grow the biggest watermelons in the world. And I said, who's that? And they said, that's Bill Clinton. He's from Arkansas, and that's all he ever talks about.
This week's collection of archives from the Pryor Center places the focus on Secretary Clinton's arrival in Arkansas 50 years ago.
And the musical legacy of Arkansan Johnny Taylor.
First, the news from NPR. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, May 13th, 2024. I'm Matthew Moore. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF Public Radio. First today, a new report shows that Springdale-based Tyson Foods dumped several millions of pounds of toxic chemicals into waterways across the U.S. The study from the Union of Concerned Scientists details the company's wastewater pollution from meatpacking plants over a span of 5 years from 2018 to 2022 and alleges that the runoff, which includes nitrogen, phosphorus, chloride, oil, and cyanide, is leading to environmental dead zones and potential human health risks. Dr. Stacy Woods and Dr. Omanjana Goswami were the lead researchers on the study titled Waste Deep and spoke with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth ahead of publishing their findings.
I think one of the things that really shocked Omanjana and I when we were looking at this information is that, Tyson processing plants released over 371 million pounds of pollutants directly into waterways between 2018 and 2022. And that is what they told the EPA. That is, you know, just the state of affairs. And so we were really shocked when we found that the total was over 370 million pounds of pollution just dumped directly into waterways from Tyson plants.
And I want to get into some of that. You know, when we're talking about this type of pollution into these waterways, what is going into the water? What is that coming from? And then what is the impact that it's having on those communities, on those environments where it's going into?
So nitrogen and phosphorus is basically being discharged, you know, from processing of animals, from washing of animals, cleaning of equipment, and also from like animal fecal matter. And all of that gets collected with other pollutants like chlorides, sulfates, you know, oil and grease. There's a long list. And then all of it gets dumped out of the plant into, just like Stacy mentioned, you know, pristine waters all over the country. Nitrogen and phosphorus in particular have a direct impact on the ecosystem. What it does, it causes algal blooms. It gives algae kind of power to grow very quickly because these are essential nutrients. And what happens is because algae grow in the water very quickly, they suck up all the oxygen that's in the water. And then that causes a phenomenon which is called eutrophication, which means that, you know, there's less dissolved oxygen in the water, less available for plants and aquatic animals to use. And all of that cause what is eventually called a dead zone, which means nothing can survive in it because there's no oxygen in the water and everything around it is dead. There is a huge dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which has directly been attributed to nitrogen and phosphorus pollution. Basically, you're looking at, you know, something that's been released all over the country and ends up creating dead zones, even locally. We are not even talking about what's happening in the waterways locally, but also has a huge impact on the environment. And then there's the price, you know, the communities around these plants pay in terms of poor air quality, poor water quality, and other kind of damaging human health impacts.
You know, human health impacts include exacerbation of asthma and bronchitis and these respiratory symptoms and people who live close to high levels of nitrogen and phosphorus and these algal blooms and these dead zones. We also found that Tyson meat processing plants released nitrates into waterways, directly into waterways in Nebraska and in Texas during that 5-year span that we were looking at. And this is a particular concern because nitrates have been associated with human health outcomes like cancer and also birth defects.
What you said at the beginning definitely sticks out. This is what they are reporting to the EPA. This is technically legally allowable to pollute this much. So how is that possible? What are the regulations? What are the rules? What is the compliance that a company like Tyson needs to do in this situation?
So under the Clean Water Act, the Environmental Protection Agency, the US EPA, is in charge of keeping an eye on and enforcing these limits. We call it the effluent, the gross discharge, the dirty water that's coming out of these plants with the pollutants. The effluent limit laws on slaughterhouses haven't been updated in 20 years. The good news is that EPA is actually in the process right now of updating those rules. And the Union of Concerned Scientists provided some feedback on that. And we're really excited to see what EPA does. And we're really in support of updating and tightening these regulations so that there is less allowed pollution, and that includes less nitrogen, less phosphorus coming from these and other industrial sources of these water pollutants.
And as far as this study, you know, why look at Tyson? What is it about this company specifically that, I don't know, does it say something maybe more substantial about the industry as a whole?
Actually, I'm going to quote Amanjana here. She says, if you have ever had chicken nuggets from a fast food restaurant or gotten meat or a hamburger or bacon from the grocery store, you're likely a consumer of Tyson Foods. Tyson is a mammoth industrial player here in the United States and actually internationally as well. So we think that by focusing on Tyson and showing how this one mega corporation is causing all of this environmental harm. And we think that there are ways that we can help reduce that negative impact.
And one of the ways that we can sort of balance this out is by passing a more fair food and farm bill, the Agriculture Resilience Act, the Farm System Reform Act, which actually directly looks at the monopolistic practices by meat packers, the Protecting America's Meatpacking Workers Act. And this looks at creating better workplace standards for the meatpacking industry, and then having more local slaughterhouses. So, you know, people don't need to take their meat to Tyson or sell their meat to Tyson to process. And that would be the Strengthening Local Food Processing Act.
Tyson is based in Arkansas, but I then noticed, you know, basically along our border with Oklahoma, that's where a lot of this pollution, those blooms, these spots pick up. What is the data looking like in this region?
So in Arkansas, Tyson meat processing plants that had reportable water pollution between 2018 and 2022 released over 37 million pounds of pollutants that were dumped directly into Arkansas waterways. There were a total of 9 Tyson meat processing plants in Arkansas that had reportable water pollution between 2018 and 2022. And these plants released pollutants including nitrogen, and that includes ammonia, phosphorus, and other pollutants like chloride and chlorine. The worst plant during this time period was the Tyson Food plant in Nashville that released more than 13 million pounds of pollutants directly into waterways between 2018 and 2022.
You know, if just a regular person who lives in one of these areas, what do you hope they get out of a report like this? Or how do you contextualize it for them to help them understand this is how these pollutants act in your community and how it impacts your life?
One of the main purposes of our report is to let people know that, you know, there's a big company there polluting your waterways. And this company is not just doing it in your state, but doing it across 17 states of the country. So really, it has a grasp over what you eat, as well as over your access to nature and fresh, clean water, fresh, clean air.
I wanted to point out that some of the water polluting plants in Arkansas are located in areas of what we call environmental justice concern. That is, communities where people live with more pollution, less power, and worse health compared to other areas of the United States. So if you go to the online maps, you can really investigate and see how these areas of environmental justice concern are in proximity to some of the Tyson plants that are polluting the water in Arkansas. I also wanted to kind of revisit something that we had talked about earlier and say that, you know, using the online maps, you can also trace that river-to-river pathway from the Arkansas River all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. So you can really see how a Tyson meat processing plant that dumps pollution into a stream that empties into the Arkansas River, you know, might end up adding to that pollution in the Gulf of Mexico.
In an email response to Ozarks at Large, a spokesperson from Tyson Foods said, quote, "We consistently monitor effluent from our facilities, and we work closely with our federal and state regulators, as well as our local municipalities, as we plan, design, and operate our wastewater systems. This report does not acknowledge our ongoing compliance with EPA regulations and certification by the Water Alliance for our strong water management practices." End quote.
That was Ozarks at Large reporter Daniel Carruth speaking with the Union of Concerned Scientists researchers Stacy Woods and Omanjana Goswami about their latest report, Waste Deep, How Tyson Foods Pollutes U.S. Waterways and Which States Bear the Brunt. Ahead this hour, a Pryor Center interview with Hillary Clinton is now available to the public, from teaching at the Arkansas Law School to moving into the governor's mansion. This week's dip into Arkansas history is ahead. Efforts continue to be made to combat the Arkansas opioid crisis. NWA Harm Reduction Center and Yancey's Dixon Street Dogs are just a few contributing to help the cause. Ozarks at Large's Quinn Cook brings us this report.
Chris Jones is a certified peer recovery specialist who works for Eagle Crest Recovery and Northwest Arkansas Harm Reduction.
So Northwest Arkansas Harm Reduction is just in the name, a harm reduction organization, and so we provide Narcan or Naloxone to active users or their family members to keep somebody safe in the event of an overdose, and then also sterile use supplies for somebody that may not be ready for recovery yet. We want to prevent potential barriers to treatment, whether that's anything that could be contracted through unsafe use.
Jones has seen Narcan administered, but hasn't had to do it to someone himself. He says there might be a reason for this.
That's one of the struggles a lot of the people that we distribute to, if they're using, there's a lot of stigma around using, and so they're alone. Mm-hmm. And so they're unable to administer it on themselves.
A big point that Jones stresses is that having Narcan on hand is never a bad idea. A drug someone thinks they are initially taking might be more potent than what they think.
Just this weekend, I met with an individual using meth here in Northwest Arkansas, and she's like, "Oh, I don't need it. I don't use opiates." At this point, any street level drug is, there's a good chance there's fentanyl in it, mm-hmm. which we would need the Narcan for the reversal.
One way to potentially prevent death or an overdose is testing substances beforehand.
And so one of the things that we hand out is a fentanyl test strip, and that's a small little cardboard paper strip used for testing a substance before ingestion to see if there's fentanyl in it. Because there is a lot of people that are unknowingly using fentanyl, thinking that it's something else.
Jones says it is critical that drug addiction is not stereotyped.
There isn't a demographic for substance use disorder. As far, like, for me, it could be the unsheltered population of South Fayetteville. It could be the college students. It could be the professional working in a corporate setting somewhere. I think that it is, for the college age, the experimenting with things that we might not have used elsewhere. And so I think that that's where there's an extra level of danger.
Although not talked about as widely, Jones says college students need to be looked out for.
Depending on what somebody's using, there's probably a stigma around using in college, whether it's going out on Dixon and getting something, not wanting other people to think differently of you for using. And so using alone or using without letting other people know what you're doing. Me, I'm very non-judgmental about what somebody's doing, and that, I hope, allows them to come to me in the event that they need help without feeling like I'm going to think differently of them.
Cody Yancey is the owner of Yancey's Dixon Street Dogs, and his spot by the train depot has manifested into much more than a hot dog stand. He offers a place especially for college students in difficult situations, whether it be drug-related or other worries.
It just organically happened, where I'm just the kind of person that wanted to help out a little bit, and over the nights that I've worked, you know, I would see people that would need some help, and I would help them, and I wouldn't think anything about it, like just trying to be a decent person. But then I start realizing, like, there's more of these people than I thought. And, you know, I'm just helping the ones that I see. So maybe I should start kind of advertising it to the folks that are here and let them know, like, hey, if you need me, it's okay for you to come find me. So that's kind of when I started deeming the area as a safe space and letting people know that I'm willing to help. And took the training on the opioid overdose medicine, Narcan.
As a part of having a safe zone for people on Dixon, Yancey has made it a point to let people know that he administers Narcan for anyone in need of it. His training has taught him
to identify an overdose, how to administer the Narcan, and then what to do afterwards. It's very simple stuff. And again, like I said, they told me that under state law, there's like a Good Samaritan law or something like that that protects people like us. So it's like, I don't have to worry about harming somebody or them getting angry and suing me or something.
Under these laws, administering Narcan won't legally hurt those trying to issue it. It also cannot hurt someone it's used on.
They said also if you misidentify the overdose and it's like, okay, I think this person's overdosing on this, I'm going to give them Narcan. Turns out they weren't overdosing on that, they were just drunk and they didn't need Narcan. Apparently Narcan won't harm them.
After 15 years of being on Dixon, Yancey says he's never seen a person overdose. However, that doesn't mean they don't happen.
Not to say that somebody doesn't walk off the street and it happens a block away, but you know, I am right on the strip, and I think oftentimes people in those situations try to find maybe a better place to be with the last kind of width that they have to themselves. So, you know, maybe they're slightly off the street or in an Uber or in a bar and they hadn't made it out, or I don't know. I've wondered that too.
Yancey's family serves as a motivation for why he keeps an eye out for those on Dixon Street.
I've got kids, my daughter's 9, you know, it's like, that's happened in the blink of an eye, and I know she's gonna be a college student in another blink of an eye, and it's like, I really, really hope that there's somebody out there looking out for her when that happens, and I just wanna be that person, you know, I feel like a dad down here. Maybe if I was gonna give myself a title, I'd be like the dad of Dixon Street.
In any situation, his stand by the train depot is open to anyone on Dixon Street.
I tried to provide a safe place for people to be, and most of the time, it's just somewhere safe to sit and wait for an Uber, or like, hey, this guy is kind of creeping me out. I don't know if it's a big deal or not. Maybe I'll just go hang out at Yancey's and kind of wait for him to float away. So a lot of it is just maybe little things that could be big things.
Yancey and Jones have been able to spread advocacy and offer help to those struggling with opioid use. When speaking on the issue, Jones says,
it is more and more prevalent, and I do believe it is a crisis.
Although opioid use continues to be a problem, testing substances as well as being non-judgmental to those using could help prevent unfortunate outcomes. For Ozarks at Large, this is Quinn Cook.
And I heard this voice saying, not only that, we grow the biggest watermelons in the world. And I said, who's that? And they said, that's Bill Clinton. He's from Arkansas, and that's all he ever talks about.
Very familiar voice there, Randy Dixon.
Hello, Kyle.
Hello. Who did we just hear?
That was Hillary Rodham Clinton. She, you know, the former first lady of both Arkansas and the United States. She was a U.S. senator and she was Secretary of State under Obama, and lived here for a couple of decades, as you should all know.
Not only did she live in Arkansas, but she lived in both Little Rock and Fayetteville.
That's correct.
Let me just remind folks, in case they don't know or have forgotten, that Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. And like we do almost every Monday, we're talking about some Arkansas history with the help of material from the Pryor Center.
Well, and this is a special interview that the Pryor Center did with Secretary Clinton. It was done some time ago. It was right before COVID.
Oh, my.
So it's been a while. It was in 2019, but we have sort of held on the release of the interview because this, believe it or not, is the 50th anniversary of her moving to Arkansas.
Okay.
So moved here in 74. And we have taken this interview. It was an almost two-hour interview with Angie Maxwell. You know Angie.
I know Angie.
Yeah, she's a professor of political science here at the UA, and she's also the director of the Diane Blair Center for Southern Politics and Society.
Author and
right.
All-around smart person.
Absolutely. And we partnered with her and the Diane Blair Center, and we conducted this interview and wanted to release. Now, it's been enhanced with material from the KETV archives. So many of these things, this is an interview, and let me explain that it's strictly her time in Arkansas.
So it's not about being in the Senate. It's not about
the
White House.
No, it's strictly that almost 20 years that she was in Arkansas. And that's why we've taken our time to kind of release it. And this seemed like an appropriate time to do so. And like I said, it's enhanced with archival footage. So if she's talking about bringing high school students to the governor's mansion in the early 80s, that's you see it because we have this vast archive of.
So it's not a static two-camera operation for the 2 hours?
No.
Gotcha.
No, it's not. So it's a little more interesting than that, but it is the complete interview. And so this week, we're going to do this in two parts.
Mm-hmm.
It's now available on our website in the Arkansas Memories section, along with the others, but it'll also, there'll be a link on your website,
yep.
Correct?
Yep, go to ozarksatlarge.com or KUAF.com.
Okay, and so this week we're going to hear about how she got here and how she adjusted, you know, from growing up in a suburb of Chicago and being educated at Wellesley College and Yale Law School to living here in the South. And, yeah, it was an adjustment. So, first of all, let's let her finish that thought that we heard at the beginning about meeting Bill Clinton for the first time.
In fact, there was a lot of truth to it. He was so proud to be from Arkansas. Yeah. He loved the state. He loved the people. He'd been born in Hope, raised in Hot Springs, went to high school there, then off to Georgetown. But he literally could not wait to get back to Arkansas. It was his just his heart home. And so once we, you know, made acquaintance and then we started dating, he would tell me story after story about the people that he knew from Arkansas. And it was very clear he knew what he was going to do. He was going to graduate from law school and then he was going home to Arkansas. And so when we started to date, it was very clear that this relationship would, really be dependent upon whether or not I would live in Arkansas.
Right, so they've met, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll both be in Arkansas.
Right, they started dating, and they both graduated from Yale in 73, and Bill started working as a law professor at the U of A, and Hillary was visiting Fayetteville when an interesting call came to both of them, actually.
Bill got called by John Doerr, who was the recently hired lead counsel on the impeachment inquiry staff investigating Nixon. Mm-hmm. And John Doerr called and said, you know, I'm putting together a staff. You have been highly recommended, along with four of your classmates who just graduated from Yale, to be kind of the young lawyers on the team. Would you be interested? And Bill said, well, I've decided I'm going to run for Congress. He said, but if you don't mind, who are the other names? And so John Doerr said the names, and one of them was my name. He goes, oh, well, she's right here. So I talked to John Doerr, and he asked me if I wanted to move to Washington and investigate Richard Nixon. I said, I think I do.
I think I do.
So that was a very eventful visit
to
Fayetteville in January of 74.
So what happens?
Well, Secretary Clinton is off to Washington and was a part of, you know, the group investigating Nixon and gathering evidence for a possible impeachment trial. But as history now shows, before the proceedings could even start, Nixon resigned, and now Hillary's looking for work.
So he resigned August 8th in 1974. And so I was out of a job. There was not going to be a trial. And I thought, well, you know, I really need to make this decision about whether or not Bill and I are going to be married. So I had met the dean of the law school on that earlier visit in January of 74. There was a dinner party. He and other members of the faculty were there, since Bill was on the faculty. And as I was leaving the dinner party, the dean said, if you ever want a job, call. So I called him. I said, Dean Davis, his name was Wiley Davis. I said, I'm out of a job. So do you think that I could get a position this late at the law school? He said, oh, sure. Come on down. Classes start, as I, you know, like August 20th, some very early period, very compressed. I said, so what will I teach? He said, I'll tell you when you get there.
She is one of only two female law professors at the University of Fayetteville. During that time, she also was the first director of a new legal aid clinic at the law school, and also helped fund the first rape crisis center in Fayetteville.
Wow.
You know, she really enjoyed teaching and interacting with students, even though she really wasn't much older and maybe even younger than some of the students she was teaching. But here's she talked a lot about that, but here's one of the stories she told about dealing with a problem student.
He just was sort of not getting what I was trying to pull out of him. And finally, he just looked at me and said, what do you expect? I'm just from Arkansas. I was furious. I was furious because, first of all, I'd had enough experience by then to know that I had some really, really good students. And I said, you know, that is just unbelievable that you would say that. You know, some of you are as smart as anybody I've ever been around, and you should know that. And most of you are working really hard, and I don't want to hear any excuses. Mm-hmm. You know, you do your work. And, you know, it's not an excuse of where you are from, and certainly not from a whole state that is, you know, supporting your legal education if you didn't prepare and you aren't ready to answer the questions. But I thought, wow, that is a really telling remark.
They don't know how smart they are.
They don't know how smart they are. They don't believe it. They don't have the confidence about it. And I remember talking to Bill about it because, you know, having gone to Yale Law School, and obviously people there are smart, but my students at Fayetteville, you know, were already as smart or on their way to being as smart, but they didn't have the confidence in their intelligence that often makes the difference between where you are and where you end up.
Okay, so now Hillary's living in Arkansas, but she's still not agreed to marry Bill. He's asked her twice. She said no. And he said he was just going to wait until she was going to say yes before he'd ask again. But, you know, the Clinton House here in Fayetteville.
Stone's throw from our studio.
Yeah, just right down the road. Well, that was their first house together. And he kind of used this as a, I guess, a bargaining chip to get her to the altar.
You know, that house was a house that literally I drove by. Bill was taking me to the airport, and I saw a for sale sign. All I said was, you know, it's a sweet-looking house. It's a cute little house. Mm-hmm. It's all I said. So I was gone for a couple of weeks, and Bill picked me up at the airport. And by this time, he'd asked me to marry him twice. And he said, I'm not asking you again until you're ready to say yes. So we're driving from the airport, and he goes, well, I bought that house you liked, so now you're going to have to marry me. I said, what house? He said, you know, the one you liked near the university. I didn't remember it, but when we pulled up, I thought, oh, my God, I do remember it now. And he had bought the house, and he had furnished the house.
No.
He had gone to Barbara Pryor's mother's antique store. And he had bought an old white iron bed that he had, you know, put together in the bedroom. And he'd gone to, I don't know, Walmart's or Kmart at that time somewhere and bought sheets. And that's what he thought furnishing the house meant. There was no other furniture, but, you know, there was a place to sleep. And it was so touching. So, you know, some weeks later, I said, yeah, we should get married. So we did get married in the house.
I'd heard this story, not from her, but I'd heard a legend of this story
and
before.
It's great to hear her tell it. And, you know, so they go back with the Pryors for years and years. He went shopping at David Pryor's mother's antique store. So, yeah, this is such a small state.
Right.
Everybody knows everybody. But they did get married at the house in a small ceremony, just family and a few friends. After that, Bill ran, as we know, unsuccessfully for 3rd District Congress against
John Paul Hammerschmidt.
Incumbent Hammerschmidt. But 2 years later, he did win the statewide race for attorney general. So now they were packing up again and going from Fayetteville to Little Rock. And for Secretary Clinton, it was kind of a hard move for her.
She had a lot of friends here, right?
Yes, she did.
And Henry and people like that.
That's right. And Diane Blair.
Right.
And so here she is talking about as tough as it was, she adapted pretty quickly.
You know, it was hard to leave Fayetteville because I had made such great friends. You know, Ann Henry, Margaret Willock, Diane Blair, wonderful friends, great women. So I was starting over again because I knew some people in Little Rock, but not in the same way that I'd gotten close to people in Fayetteville. So when I joined the Rose Law Firm, I was the only woman there as a lawyer. I became the first woman partner a few years later. So it was a different set of challenges, you know, representing clients. You know, some of them had never had a woman lawyer.
Right.
So there was a little bit of, you know, kind of jockeying, like, mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know, a woman lawyer, I don't know. Some of them had litigation, which is what I was interested in doing, and they were worried about judges, you know, who hadn't had many women lawyers in the courtroom, sure. Or juries who hadn't seen many women lawyers. So it was a rather constant proving ground.
And she also, in this interview, has great stories about when she was a young attorney, female, mm-hmm. which was unusual mm-hmm. at the time, traveling around the state, especially in, you know, some of these small towns. So here's one story that I picked out of there that she's trying a case before a particular judge who happens to be under investigation by the state.
And the judge, you know, had been put under investigation by the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General happened to be my husband. One of the reasons why I was using my maiden name mm-hmm. was to have a distinction between sure. my profession and Bill's, you know, government service. So we start the day with the judge announcing, it was a trial to the court, how pretty I looked, and would I stand up and just swirl around and show everybody my pretty outfit. Of course, I had on a dress and all that. And end of the day by him dismissing the case against our client. So my senior partner and I left, only later to learn that he was sitting around talking to the other lawyers, cursing out my husband because the attorney general was investigating him. And one of the lawyers popped and said, well, that girl lawyer that you said looked so pretty this morning, she's married to the attorney general. And the judge, well, if I'd known that, I wouldn't have dismissed the case against them.
You know, by the way, she talked about, you know, using her
right.
maiden name, Rodham. And, you know, I remember people grumbling about, oh, she just, you know.
Yep. I remember hearing that.
Won't take his name. And she's Northern. I mean,
I remember
she got a really bad rap.
Yes.
Especially early on.
Now, I do remember I would have been, a preteen or maybe a young teenager at this time. I remember my mother and many of her fellow teachers loving that she was using.
Right, right.
They just, they really admired that.
Progressive people yes. around the state did. Unfortunately, a lot of them in the state weren't.
Right.
And, you know, I always heard the stories being in the news that, you know, one of the reasons that Clinton lost that first election against Frank White, that part of the reason was Hillary Clinton, Hillary Rodham, that, you know, she was too independent, too forceful, I guess you would say, that, you know, early 70s, mid-70s Arkansas.
I mean, we're Arkansans, and Winthrop Rockefeller notwithstanding, we to this day can be sort of overly suspicious of outsiders.
Sure.
Yeah, sometimes to our credit, but sometimes to our detriment.
No, it's always been a problem.
Yeah.
You know, but despite all that, she did make Arkansas her home for two decades. So, you know, that we got her here. So, right. Now, next week, why don't we look and see what she did here, what kind of effect Arkansas had on her, and what kind of effect she had on our state. And she certainly did.
All right. Well,
positively.
Yes. We will follow that up. We'll follow this up, rather, with part two next Monday. You can find out more about this interview and so much other Arkansas history. Just put Pryor Center into a search engine. Randy, we'll talk again next week.
Thank you. I'll see you next week.
This is Ozarks at Large. It's a cloudy, rainy Monday, but you know who's going to brighten it up for us? Jasper Logan, who is our community engagement manager at KUAF. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. Thank you. No pressure at all.
No, none at all. Our well-being completely depends on you telling us that there are fun things ahead for us.
Well, luckily, there are some fun things.
Excellent.
And speaking of rain and sunshine,
yes,
the first thing is Benton County's Master Gardener Plant Sale happening at the Bentonville First United Methodist Church this Saturday and Sunday, or the 17th and 18th, from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. You'll be able to purchase thousands of plants ranging from vegetable starts to house plants, along with flowers and native plants and shrubs. And this year, they're adding an expo with local experts speaking informally on all things garden and green. And so you'll be able to purchase your plant with a little bit of information as well.
I always need information. That's me too. I really do.
I feel the same. Okay.
All right.
So I was driving south on 49 yesterday, and I drove by, I think it's exit 72, the exit that you take to get to the airport.
Right.
And I just remember seeing it was like probably like 6 p.m., 6:30.
Okay.
Sun was setting. It's very beautiful. And I just was looking at the grass and I was like, man, this is a very beautiful place.
It really is.
And I was wondering, what local spaces or spots like that do you have that you go to, that you look at and you go, yeah, this is beautiful, that are green?
Right. Well,
that's a lot.
This is in our listening area. You got to drive a little bit.
Okay.
But if you get to between Jasper and Witt Springs, I mean, there are beautiful places elsewhere, but if you can get into like Newton County and then over to Stone County.
I've never been over there.
Oh, my gosh. This time of year, beautiful.
Wow.
Beautiful. Okay. The drive from Witt Spring to Snowball.
Mm. Witt Spring to Snowball.
Yes. Gorgeous.
Are these cities or?
Well, I wouldn't.
Is there a town?
They're places that have signs.
Okay.
Just over by Deer, if you've ever been to Deer.
I don't think I've ever been to Deer.
You and I are going to get in a car.
Yeah, we just need to head. Is that south?
It's south and east.
Southeast?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. The next thing is the Ozark Folkways and the Wool and Wheel Spinners Guild are having a fiber play. Fiverr Play Day, and that's Saturday, May 18th from 10 a.m. to midnight. It's basically a free and open house Fiverr Play Day for anyone interested in fiber arts, regardless of skill level. So you can come in and learn how to make fiber arts.
Speaking of beautiful places over there in Winslow, it's till midnight.
It's till midnight, yeah. 11:59 p.m.
Okay, so I'm... If they'll let me make a quilt I can go to bed at 9.
They probably will.
Yeah.
Speaking of making quilts.
Yes.
Have you ever made anything like that?
You know, in eighth grade for, I think it was Arkansas History, we had to do something that was some sort of project that was, I don't know, pioneer infused. So my mom convinced me to make a quilt.
That's cool.
And I got a B- on it, and I've... not let that go, apparently, because I thought it deserved better.
Have you made anything since?
Not like that.
Not like that.
How about, are you a, do you?
You know, I would like to be.
Yeah.
You know, I went to the library, had like a similar thing like this, and like there was someone outside like making a sword, like literally like.
A sword?
A sword. Like, you know, like the whole like, you know, boom, hitting it and running it on a tool. And, and I was like, in another life, I think I would have liked to do that.
I'm going
to
go with a quilt. Sword scares me. Hey, did you see the Northern Lights by any chance?
I did not.
I didn't
get to see it. But I you know, I had I had some friends who sent me pictures, and they saw it, and they said it was great.
Yeah.
But they also said that, like, sometimes, like, you couldn't really see it, but when you took a picture on it, you saw
that's what I heard.
Which was great.
But no, I didn't see him either.
Dang, we missed it.
I was under a quilt.
I was
I was fast asleep.
Same.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, and the last thing is the momentary. AWOL Erizku just opened his latest exhibition at the momentary called Mystic Parallax. It blends his studio practice with work made as an in-demand editorial photographer and features his conceptual portraits of leading black cultural figures such as Michael B. Jordan, Pharrell Williams, and Solange. I like this quote from him. He says, "It's important for me to create confident, powerful, downright regal images of black people." And this is up at the momentary through October.
Free.
Free. I don't have a question for that.
Okay. All right. Have you ever, I'm going to ask you a question.
Come on, do it.
All right. Have you ever had a photograph made of you that you just thought, yes, I really like that. I feel comfortable with that image?
You know, that's it. I don't know if I have.
Yeah.
You know, I think like, well, I guess I have because like I've created some albums. And so I have cover arts for those.
Yeah.
But to me, they like. It's more so about fitting a certain like mystique and like type. It's less about me.
Right.
But I don't know if I've like set out to like, all right, I'm going to capture an image that's like authentically me. Interesting.
I think because you have we shouldn't judge on physical appearance alone, so I'm not. But you have a very attractive family.
Oh, thank you.
Your children are beautiful.
Yeah,
you are a handsome man. You should have a picture made.
Well, that's funny you said that.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the next the through line in my next project.
Okay,
and that is my thought process for the artwork.
Excellent. So momentary is free. Fiber art Saturday till midnight.
Yep.
And then, the plants.
The plants, which we have been talking about. This is probably our third instance of saying we want to start planting.
Yes. Get your hands in the dirt. Where can we find out about these things?
You can find about all of these things on KUAF.com/community calendar. And again, if you have an event that you want people to know about, go ahead and throw it on there. It's super easy and quick. And we will probably talk about it.
Thank you, Jasper.
Thanks.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Well, I dreamed that heaven was like this. Oh, though I've never been up there. Well,
Johnny Taylor was born May 3rd, 1934 in Crawfordsville, Arkansas, in Crittenden County, although he always claimed to be 4 years younger. He was raised in West Memphis. Like his Lee County-born colleague Al Green and the man who has been called Taylor's mentor, Sam Cooke, Taylor got his start singing gospel in church. But early on, he also sang doo-wop with the Five Echoes, who recorded for VJ and Chance in the early 1950s. Taylor also sang with two of the most influential gospel groups, first the Highway QCs, heard in the background here from 1956, and in the late 1950s, Taylor replaced Sam Cooke in the Soul Stirrers, who were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1989. Both the Highway QCs and the Soul Stirrers had been around for years before Taylor joined and existed for years after. Although gospel in nature, both groups played big roles in the development of R&B and rock music. Their emotionally charged performances added doses of the sexual into the sacred and blurred the lines of religious and secular music. In the early 1960s, Johnny Taylor followed Sam Cooke into secular music and signed with Cooke's label, SAR. He enjoyed his first solo success with 1962's Rome Wasn't Built in a Day, obviously influenced by Sam Cooke. Sam Cooke's murder in December 1964 left Taylor looking for a recording contract. Taylor claimed he flipped a coin to decide whether to go to Motown in Detroit or Stax Records in Memphis. The choice was Stax, headed up by Brinkley-born Al Bell, and it proved a wise choice for both the artist and the label. From his first Stax single in February 1966, I Had a Dream, until Stax folded in the mid-1970s, Johnny Taylor was one of the most successful artists on the label. In fall of 1968, he cut Who's Making Love, a song he initially disliked, calling it the Boogity Boogity song. Taylor liked it better after it sold 2 million copies, reached number one on the R&B charts and number five on the pop charts, and was nominated for a Grammy. It became Stax's biggest single to date.
Hear me now. All you fellas, gather around me. And let me give you some good advice. What I'm gonna...
After Stax Records folded, Taylor had other hits, including 1976's mega hit Disco Lady, the first single ever to be certified platinum. But the gritty soul singer had since morphed into a smooth balladeer. Johnny Taylor died of a heart attack on May 31st, 2000 in Dallas, where he had lived for more than 30 years. Since the early 1980s, he had recorded for Malico Records, the self-proclaimed last soul company, and Taylor's last single, Soul Heaven, ironically described a rhythm and blues concert with deceased performers from the past. Taylor is buried in Kansas City, Missouri. Here's Crawfordsville, Arkansas's own Johnny Taylor with the Grammy-nominated number one R&B hit from 1968, Who's Making Love?
Hear me now. All you fellas, gather around me and let me give you some good advice. What I'm gonna ask you now. You'd better think about it twice. Why you lying, cheating on your woman? Something you never even thought of.
Another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansas Arts Council bringing Arkansas performers and audiences together through its Arts on Tour grant. Learn more at arkansasarts.org.
The Razorback softball team will host an NCAA regional beginning Friday. Razorbacks are the number 12 overall seed in the NCAA tournament and will host Villanova, Arizona, and Southeast Missouri State this weekend. For the Razorbacks, first game is Friday night at 7:30 against SEMO at Bogle Park. Razorback baseball team will close the regular season later this week with three games at Texas A&M. Arkansas will enter that series in College Station with a two-game lead over the Aggies for first place in the SEC West. Razorbacks one game behind Kentucky for the overall SEC lead. First game of that series set for Thursday night. Arkansas men's track team won the SEC Outdoor Championships this weekend in Gainesville, Florida, their fourth straight year. Completes the SEC Triple Crown for the program because they won also cross-country and indoor SEC titles this year. The women's team finished second in Gainesville this weekend. And the Razorback women's golf team opens play in the NCAA Championships Friday in Carlsbad, California. This after winning the Las Vegas Regional last week. Arkansas enters the tournament ranked ninth in the country.
Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville. Contributors today included Daniel Carruth, Quinn Cook, Randy Dixon, Jasper Logan, and Stephen Cook.
Two Cooks spelled differently.
That's right.
If you're keeping track at home. Matthew produced today's show in the Bruce and Ann Applegate News Studio 2. Listening to the Razorback baseball game yesterday, I heard something happen in a baseball game I'd never heard before.
That feels like saying a lot.
So, I think it was in the seventh inning, Mississippi State had a runner at first. He goes to steal second. It's ball four to the batter. So, the runner is automatically, obviously, awarded second.
Yeah.
He gets in there. He overslid the base because he didn't know there had been a walk. Kept the tag on him. He was out. I'd never heard of that before.
Amazing.
All right. I'm Kyle Kellums.
Matthew Moore. Be with you tomorrow.
Arkansas Senior Health Insurance Information Program reminds listeners that May is Older Americans Month. AR SHIP will answer Medicare questions and provide confidential, unbiased education. More information at 1-800-224-6330. That's 800-224-6330. KUAF is partnering with The Momentary to give away two-day passes to Fresh Grass Bentonville May 17th and 18th. This all-ages festival features live music performances, workshops, local vendors, and more. Winners announced May 15th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Giveaway entry at KUAF.com. More information and tickets at themomentary.org/freshgrass.